people have powerful feelings about the traffic in Los Angeles, it says something that local officials warned motorists about a temporary road work closure on the 405 last year by calling it Carmageddon. Angelenos took the hint, and this weekend they're expected to steer clear of the latest 405 closure, named, of course, Carmageddon 2. That's how it is in L.A., a snarl of overstuffed freeways and commuters who keep their cool, except when they don't. KPCC's Stephen Cuevas has this profile of a punk rocker whose music expresses the insanity of L.A. traffic while extolling the virtues of public transit.
Couple of things you need to know about Eddie Solis. He lives in L.A., loves the band Kiss, and does not own a car.
Being someone who's from L.A., born and raised, and, you know, having a few cars in my past, I saw the city much differently through a different perspective through the eyes of a bus rider.
Want this all the way to the back?
Sure. Line 18, Wilshire Western Station.
Just steps from the front door of his home, across the street from a tortilla factory in L.A.'s Boyle Heights neighborhood, Solis catches a bus that connects him with the city's subway and the commuter train he catches to his day job at an indie record label in Hollywood.
It just opened me up to, like, little neighborhoods, galleries, clubs, bars, just everything. Just seeing what's out there, little pockets of the city.
Solis's journeys aboard L.A. buses and subway cars informs a lot of the material on The New Los Angeles Part 1, Through the Eyes of a Bus Rider, the latest release by the singer-guitarist band It's Casual. In Solis's vision of a new Los Angeles, people abandon their cars, climb aboard public transit, and rediscover their communities. One song extols the virtues of the L.A. County Metropolitan Transit Agency's Easy Pass and the urban underbelly it introduces to the rider.
And that's a nod and homage to, you know, the people who know what you can even go cheaper and really beat the system and really steer away from spending money on gas and oil profits and all that. Is all it takes for me to witness racial tension, for me to witness illegal aliens. It's not to paint a negative picture, it's just my perspective of what is seen.
Off the bus and back on the street, we make our way past a jazz saxophonist playing for pocket change and down a long escalator to catch a train.
So, where are we now?
We're at the Red Line station, the Pershing Square station in downtown L.A.
And what's our destination?
We're going to go down Fairs, another tier, and in about 5 minutes, we're going to get on the Red Line going northbound.
Okay, yeah. Let's go. Cool.
The Metro Red Line snakes from North Hollywood to downtown Los Angeles. It's the train that inspired It's Casual's signature tune and spawned a viral internet video. It was partly filmed late at night on a moving train as it hurtles from station to station. Solis thrashes away on his guitar and barks the lyrics, which celebrate the Red Line and call out the congested freeways that coil around Los Angeles.
Este es un tren de Metro Red Line a North Hollywood.
Not so nice, the I-5, the 210, the freeways are not so nice.
The thread that comes out of the record that ties everyone together is just like, be alive, don't be a victim of having a car.
MTA spokesman said he couldn't comment on Eddie Solis's furious pro-Metro message, but the Red Line video was a hit at the offices of Move LA.
Eddie's done a good job. Thank you, Eddie.
It's the public transportation advocacy group headed by former Santa Monica Mayor Denny Zane. He liked the juxtaposition of Solis blissfully riding L.A. public transit in one scene with scenes of the band raging against those notorious freeway jams.
Eddie is all frantic when he talks about highways. And so mellow when he's like grooving on a skateboard and on the bus and on the Red Line, there's a metaphor for the transformation, you know, from the, oh my God, I just got to get out of the traffic to, hey, this is cool. I can mellow out.
Or you can blast the tune like Too Many People as you claw your way across Los Angeles by car, bus, or skateboard.
Los Angeles. There's too many people. I want them to go away. Even though it means they're so afraid.
Too Many People could also be a motto for It's Casual. Over the years, the band whittled itself down to a power duo of Solis and a rotating cast of drummers. So you may think the burly, bearded punk rocker just can't get along with freeways, with people, or his native L.A. Not true.
I love it. I love everything about it. I've traveled throughout the U.S. many times, and I could never look forward enough to coming back. The weather, the different cultures, the landscape. I was just like, you know what? Now I know why everyone moves to L.A.
Solis will bring the love and the volume during a Red Line mini tour next month. It's Casual will play a different venue within walking distance of several Red Line metro stops from Union Station to West Hollywood. For the California Report, I'm Stephen Cuevas.
That's the California Report, a production of KQED Public Radio in San Francisco. Our director this week is Nina Thorson. Seal Muller is our technical producer. We had additional engineering from Danny Bringer and Howard Gelman. Thanks to Hank Hadley at KCBX. Our online team includes Lisa Pickoff-White, David Marks, and Don Clyde. Our interns are Catherine Borgeson and Rachel Johnson. Tyke Hendricks is our elections editor with production help from Tina Lauerberg. We had editing support from Paul Rogers. Victoria Malione is our associate senior producer. Ingrid Becker is our senior producer. The news director is Bruce Kuhn. I'm Rachel Miro. Thanks for listening and have a great weekend. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the James Irvine Foundation, expanding opportunity for the people of California and supporting the California Report since its premiere in 1995. And the California Endowment. Health happens in schools at calendow.org. And Chevron, investing in renewables, strengthening communities, and creating jobs. More information at chevron.com.
The 210, the 605, the freeways are not so nice. The I-5, the 210, the freeways are not so nice. The 101, the 405, the freeways are not so nice. The I-5, the I-10, the freeways are not so nice. The 210, the 605, the freeways are not so nice. The I-5, the I-10.
Welcome to another spectacular episode of Los Angeles Nista. I'm your host and creator, Edward Solis, my in-studio guest from Mas Malo and Screw. Screw Toys on Melrose.
On Virgil and Melrose.
Virgil and Melrose out in Hollywood, right?
Yeah, East Hollywood.
My guest, Robert Luna. And there's your mic.
Is this mine?
That's yours, buddy.
Great.
There he is. How you doing?
I'm good. I'm good. Doing really well.
I'm excited, man. You had a long day.
Extremely long. Extremely long. Started at 6 a.m. today.
Yeah, I wanted to get into it with you. I mean, there's just so much that I didn't know about you other than what your culinary background is.
Sure.
And your executive chef background with Malo and Masamalo. But you're actually an Angeleno.
Absolutely, through and through.
El Sereno, right?
El Sereno and then the promised land, the San Gabriel Valley.
Now, back in the day, you were really heavily involved with skate culture, skateboarding, spray the spray can on the walls and graffiti.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now you are a chef, and I know you just changed your graffiti name.
Yeah, I just started spraying chef.
So if anyone sees chef around LA, that's you.
Yeah, Highland Park area.
Highland Park area. That's really good. I love that. Now, as far as skateboarding goes, how far back do you go with that?
I've been skating since probably like 83, 82, when I was like 10, 11. And started skating actually in Orange County with my cousin, Sal Badano, at a place called Sadlands and the Ranch and the Del Mar Bowl and stuff.
Now, was there any skate parks open, or was that when they were closing?
That's when they weren't even open.
Okay.
That was pre-opening.
Pre-pipeline.
Pre-everything. Pipeline was probably going around that time.
The only one in Upland, yeah, right?
But everything else was like just starting out.
Wow. Wow. And then how was it when you guys actually discovered street skating? That's when all the parks closed. And it was mostly the streets, right?
Yeah.
The schoolyards.
Vert died and everything was going. Actually, you know, like around 84, 85, I started going to the street. And it was really like, for us growing up in L.A., it was like the best form of travel, man. Like you could go from A to B in a mall in a heartbeat. And so when it went street, man, you started like seeing all those early videos from like Bones Brigade. It was like,
Future Primitive.
Yeah, what are those dudes doing, man? Yeah. And so it kind of blew up in L.A. because we had, you know, streets and our weather was great and so
some killer schoolyards,
absolutely, yeah,
and empty pools and all that. So your approach to your day to day life definitely comes from like, you know, a skateboard perspective,
yeah,
right? Like that's kind of like your mannerism. I mean, you learned how to work hard through skateboarding.
Yeah, you could say that.
Yeah. I had Salman Aga on here. Professional skateboarder, you know Salman?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, he does from a restaurant called Pizza Nista.
Pizza Nista, yeah,
and actually,
cool.
We had a discussion about how skateboarders have a advantage over people because when you're out there learning tricks by yourself with no coach or no team, you're just motivated and you're committed to learning something over and over. You kind of make yourself see it, and then you go practice it every day. And people call that the power of visualization, but he calls it skater's advantage.
Right.
You know, and I mean, do you ever use that kind of, you know, in your strategy?
Day to day.
Day to day, right?
Day to day. Coming here was that same thing. You know, it was like I envisioned at like 6 o'clock, damn, I got to make a lot of food and I got to walk around the corner. But no, in everyday life, for me, it is that. It's like figuring out all the angles to what I'm doing, you know. And it's even getting around during the day with having to pick up produce and stuff. It's like you're trying to figure out the angles always.
Wow.
So.
Wow. So yeah, we're going to get into your day-to-day of Masamalo very soon. But let's talk about when you committed to culinary school and getting your background sharpened with, you know, your Asian cooking background and French, right?
Yeah. Started out, you know, my mom was a culinary arts teacher, my father was a baker, and eventually went to the LAPD, and my mom said, no, there's no way, my husband's going to be an officer, he's going to get killed, so he went to a job fair, became a driver for RTD. He was with him 24 years, and at the time, I was probably 14 or 15 years old, and I was like, man, I can't stand school, I'm just going to, you know, I had no vision of what I wanted to do other than just be at the beach.
Nice.
You know, in Venice and Santa Monica with my buddies hanging out. And one day I showed up at my mom's house and she was cooking, and I remember tasting something that she made and just being like taken back by it. It was just like, this wasn't normal. This wasn't like everyday food. This was like something that captivated me. And at that moment,
it was like an epiphany for you.
Yeah.
Like you connected to that.
I connected it to it in a big way. And it was something so simple. It was refried beans and it was homemade tortillas. And I just remember, like, maybe I was starving that day, maybe because I had no money. I don't remember. But I just remember from that point, I was like, this means something. This means something. So I wanted to cook and quit high school and went to go work for a couple of guys that were really good to me. One of which is the chef over at the Skirball Center, sure. Sean Sheridan. The other was a guy that's now in Buffalo named Sam Rita, and another one by the name of Robert Gatsby. And kind of just worked, you know. And at 18, I was thinking, man, I better figure out if I'm going to do this professionally. And I had the opportunity to open a restaurant.
Wow.
In Pasadena called Cafe Santorini. So I was executive chef in my first restaurant at 18. And at the time, wow. I was like, I got to do, there's something more than this. So I went to LA Trade Tech.
Okay.
And I met a woman by the name of Barbara Thompson. And she's still there. And she gave me the best advice anyone had ever given me up to that point.
Which was?
Get out of cooking school. Go do something with it. Because I had, she said, it, in her words, she said I had really natural talent for it.
So she already saw your talent was honed in and yeah. crafted. And she said, just go do it.
Yeah. And basically, you know, she had been to the restaurants that I had worked at. And she's like, you know, you're running one of the biggest restaurants in Pasadena at the time. And you're 18 years old. And it's like you get all these great write-ups and everything's happening for you. You're wasting your time here. You know, go out and make it happen. So at the time, I was not... I didn't believe it. It was like, you know, I'm this kid. I don't know. I'm still, dude, I'm riding a bicycle to work, you know. I'm still skating after my shift, you know. I'm stealing cigarettes because I think I had just turned 18. I didn't even have an ID. So I said, okay, I'm going to go. I went to PCC and I forged some transcripts and I got into, I took an astronomy class.
Are you serious?
Yeah. At the time, you know, I went to Alhambra High. I said, hey, I need some transcripts. Well, Mr. Lee, you didn't graduate. I was like, all right, well, can you give me something? And they said, well, there's really nothing to give you. So I went to PCC and I said, give me the forms. And I filled them out and I signed my teacher's names on them. And I signed Mr. Cano, I forget his other name, on it. And they took them.
Oh, man.
And I got classes. I was took astronomy and then I took a debate class. I took an English class. I took an algebra class. And I was like, man, this is awesome. So it turns out I go to... it's coming to the end of the year, and they're like, you know, Mr. Luna, none of your transcripts check out. They said, you don't have a high school diploma. I said,
so
yeah.
They called you on it.
Yeah, absolutely. But I said, but I passed all your classes. They said, yes, you did very well, too. But they don't count. So at that point,
they don't count?
Yeah, they said, you need
so they actually took them back?
Yeah. They said, if I ever wanted to get them, I had to get a high school diploma. I had to get a GED or something. I said, no way. It's not going to happen.
So they didn't honor your work?
No. Far from it.
Wow.
So I went to cooking. I went to another cooking school called the Epicurean.
Okay.
And they gave me the same advice. They said, you know, this is for housewives. This cooking school's not. It's good and we do a good job and whatever. And we're going to teach basics and stuff. But you're past that point. And I started working with a Japanese guy named Toshi in Pasadena. And I worked with him for a few years and really liked Japanese food, really liked the art of cutting fish. And I went into that for a while.
How long were you working with Toshi?
I was with him probably almost 2 years. Just long enough to know that I don't have the hands to work in sushi.
Okay.
I'm pretty scarred up. My hands are pretty scarred up. So when people sit at a sushi bar, and I was told this by a couple of big sushi guys in the city, that they said, you know, people don't want to look at your hands. Because I have burns, pretty bad burns from the kitchen.
Okay.
And so I was like, man, I was kind of like defeated on the Japanese front. But at the same time, I had just met a guy, Sam Rita, and he took me under his wing. And by the way, I'm still running that restaurant in Pasadena. And it's still there. They do $6 million a year. It's called Cafe Santorini. My menu that I wrote, you know, 20 years ago or so is still in place.
Wow.
So it's a testament to what I was doing at the time. But it wasn't enough.
So the menu's still installed there.
Yeah, at least 40% of it is still mine.
That's amazing.
Yeah, the mezza platter and some other, like the farfalla with cilantro pesto and the baked salmon with almonds. And there's a couple other things on that are still all mine.
Wow.
So
That's killer. So as far as that goes, what's your connection present day? Do you ever go there to do like, you know, a special evening of guest chefing? Or
no, I went back like 8 years ago, right after my my divorce to my first wife. And it was like, you know what? I was there for a year and I hated it. It was just like, man, this is awful. You know, the menu was old and it was like, the place is beautiful and they redecorated, but I just say, you know, this isn't me, man. It's not cutting edge. It's not new. It's not vibrant. It's not sustainable. It's sorry for cussing.
Oh, no, you can cuss on here.
It's pedestrian food. It's passerby food. It's the guy that, you know, that just jumps off the plane and is from Nebraska and wants to eat something, you know, Californian.
Right.
And that we're not that anymore. LA is so far past that. The salmon with the beurre blanc and, you know, the cream sauces. We're so far from that right now.
Where would you say we are?
We're in the midst of actually a little bit of a food revolution here in LA. And that's taking the known and kind of pushing it aside and taking the unknown. It's a lot of people out there doing stuff with pork ears and with stomachs and eating awful and getting used to the bad cuts of meat like we did a long time ago.
Like the Mexican get bad cuts, like the tripas and the sesos.
Yeah.
And the,
you know, Saturday night drunken feast.
Yeah, the agrudo food, right?
All the stuff that when a true
stomach
chef...
Stomach lining?
Absolutely. Sesos, cheeks, hearts, lungs. You know, the thing is when a true chef or a guy that loves food and sees it, come out of the animal. He doesn't say, oh, well, let's get rid of that. That's trash. He looks and says, man, that's stuff we can cook. That's delicious.
So a good chef will use everything.
Absolutely. You know, it goes back to my French background, working with great French chefs, was that you don't always have money to buy the tenderloin. You don't always have money to buy the New York. You take the lesser of everything and you make these incredible meals. And so right now we're figuring out here in LA and abroad. I mean, it's not just here, it's abroad, but more so in LA that the food that we're doing is it means something. It's sustainable. It's something that you can take the you know, like now, I guess the pork bellies are really expensive now, you know, because everyone's eating them.
Because there's more of a demand now, right?
But before it was, you know, it was whatever. It was, you know, it was the lesser cut. Everyone wanted the loin.
Sure.
And so we're learning that there's parts of the animal that we should be eating. There's stuff that we should throw away. There's other ways to prepare food.
So is it really safe to say that, you know, within the Mexican culture here in Los Angeles and in Mexico, but, you know, just like, you know, seeing people on the weekends making, you know, the tripas and the sesos and the lengua on top of the asada and carnitas, right, and siete mares style, you know, drunk food, I mean, is it really a revolution that's taking place that's trying to utilize all those bad cuts and maybe turn it through a new pipe and push it out with something different at the end?
I think what happened was that 10 years ago, and I can remember that there was only one taco truck in Pasadena. It was called Juanita's on Fair Oaks, and they had struck gold, 2 a.m. to 4 a.m., nowhere to eat other than Juanita's truck, the yellow truck,
right
next to the parts store on Fair Oaks. And slowly it started that there was another truck down the street. Then there was another truck.
Wow.
And then there was another truck. And so all of a sudden, this whole culture of food trucks came from California. I mean, nowhere else.
SoCal.
Yeah, absolutely. Nowhere else were you getting, you know, you could get tripa tacos at 3 a.m. at the same time about 4 blocks away. You know, recently now you can get pho, you can get sushi, you can get koji burger, you can get whatever it is. And it's a whole culture. It's a whole mobile kitchen culture. And that's where we're at right now. I think that maybe it's hit its spike a little bit.
Okay.
There's maybe now everyone's doing a certain sort of truck, but the idea behind it is the right idea.
Now, would you say that because of all the cultures in Los Angeles that, you know, we all know it's a melting pot, that a lot of the foods are becoming a hybrid? Is that possible?
Yeah. The one thing that's not, and not to, you know, poke fun of anyone out there that's doing it, you know, but the one thing that's a constant is Mexican food. By far. It's the one thing that you really can't add anything, any other culture to it and make it any better. I mean, I've had, you know, the Mexican happy roll at, you know, at Wakano or...
I've had the Japanese tacos.
Right. But it's the one food that we romanticize. It's the one food that here in LA, everyone has that one friend that's mom made beans or made these tacos and you remember growing up eating them. And it's like, you romanticize it. It's
right. I mean, I had a friend about 4 years ago move here from Texas and worked for a very big concert promoter. And, you know, he's Mexican American, just like us. And he was like, hey, man, he lives in Whittier. I mean, we're not Whittier, Hollywood. And he said, I need you to take me down Whittier Boulevard in East LA and take me to get real menudo, real pan dulce, real tamales, and real tacos.
Right.
I need you to take me to get these things.
I've had that request myself from many people.
Have you noticed a lot of the transplants think Eagle Rock's the east side?
Yeah, that's about far north as you can get from the east side before you get into Glendale. Yeah, east side, you know, even, you know, the borders, you know, between El Sereno and Alhambra, which is now San Gabriel Valley,
are
light years apart. You can tell, like, from building, like, actually one block apart, you know an East LA building, you know an East LA block, you know an East LA group of houses.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's you can't deny it. Like, they blindfold you, take you to a certain area, drop you, you're like, oh, shit, I'm in East LA.
Exactly.
You know, so.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's great. Okay, so we're going to come back. We're going to talk about Masamalo. We're going to take a break, and we'll be right back. Thank you.
This is Ignacio Salcido from La Mezcla The Bakery in Boyle Heights. You're listening to LA Nista and SkidRowStudios.com.
This episode of Los Angeles Nista is brought to you by La Mezcla The Bakery, a family-owned business serving the community since 1952. Tamales and sweetbread, made the old-fashioned way daily.
Yeah. yourself.
right, welcome back to Los Angeles Nista. I'm your host, Edward Solis, and my in-studio guest, Robert Luna from Masmalo. How are you, man?
I'm good.
Well, let's talk about, we spoke about the food revolution.
Right.
Now, let's talk about the return of downtown L.A.
All right.
Not DTLA. I'm talking EL space LAY. LA.
LA.
Let's talk about the return of downtown LA. I think that there's also a downtown Los Angeles revolution happening. What do you think?
Absolutely. Yes, yeah. Indeed.
Do you remember a decade ago or even maybe 7 years ago at 6 o'clock, it was lights out and nothing but zombies walking on crack?
Yep.
Remember that?
Absolutely. Run for the hills.
They're out. Exactly. Now it's, I mean, you know, you could be at the bus stop or, you know, on Spring Street or coming out of your place and you see these people walking their $2,000 dogs and pushing strollers that live in the lofts. Nothing wrong with that, but I'm just saying it's changed.
Yeah.
Now, was that part of your strategy as a business partner in Masmalo to come to downtown?
Yeah. You know, just a quick history of, you know, for me, downtown was, you know, 1979, I was like 7 years old, and I still remember like putting on these really hard little white shoes and my little cargo pants and my little white shirt with my little jacket, and my mom would take me downtown on the bus. You know, we'd hit Newberry's.
It was a destination.
That was it.
Newberry's.
Zodies and.
Zodies, man. Newberry's had the cafe inside, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And that was like this thing, man. And then, like, you know, we'd walk into Bullock's and it was like way too expensive. So we walked down to Broadway and, you know, it was like the thing. And by 4:30, my mom's like making her way with all the packages and we eat at Clifton's and
awesome.
We're running to the bus to get out of LA because it's like, it's going to get dark soon. You got to run.
Yeah. And as soon as it's dark, you got to get the hell out of there because it turns into a, like, it's like Mad Max or something.
Yeah. It was like a no man's land, especially for like, you know, a woman with a young kid.
Sure.
So we shoot forward, you know, to, you know, early 90s. And even in the early 90s, you know, there was a lot of things going on downtown that were like, you know, the tower used to have like live sex acts. And it was, you know, this really seedy, dirty thing.
There wasn't no Pershing Square concerts at night. There wasn't no KCRW.
No farmer's market.
What's the thing that they have at the Grand's performances?
Yeah. No.
There was no Masmalo. There was no Red Line.
Yeah, no Red Line. There was no escape from L.A.
Yeah, exactly.
And so now we shoot forward, you know, another 10 years, 2000, man, and it's different. It's the lofts are coming in and people are spending money. And, you know, it's the mark of like a community when like Ralph's moves in, you know.
24-hour Ralph's underneath the lofts.
Right. It's like, oh, man, Ralph's, I don't got to go back into San Gabriel Valley and shop at Ralph's.
Right. Well, you know what's funny to me? I think that this really was significant. And, you know, I mean, LA Live. I think as soon as they installed LA Live, which has the Staples Center, Nokia Theater, the whole Nokia Plaza, Nokia, you know, Club Nokia, the Conga Room, all the restaurants and the plaza, the theaters, all that stuff. I mean, that was being built and things were still a little seedy around LA. Then as soon as that happened, all of a sudden, you know, 5 months later, 2 months later, a year later, all these lofts were opening up and it was like this trickle down effect that LA Live had. And then the subways came in, or the subways, you know, started expanding their service, the Blue Line, the Red Line. And it just all came together pretty nicely. And then I started seeing things pop up, like, you know, these galleries. And Kohl's kind of, like, had a comeback. And then I see Masmalo there.
Right.
And so forth. And, I mean, it's really, there really is a downtown revolution. Don't you think so?
Oh, absolutely. The thing for me that was, like, was that when we came into Masmalo and we were doing the finishing construction and we saw the vaulted ceilings and the dust was cleared away and we had swept and the floors were there and everything, the woodwork was there, is that we stepped outside the building and we looked in and it was like, you know, this is such a piece of history for LA, this building and all the other things around it. And it was, man, this is the revolution. This is the fight. This is what everyone that's part of any conservatory, that's part of any kind of revitalization was fighting for. Was to bring back these beautiful theaters, these beautiful buildings, and make it now just not a place that you walk around and admire, but a place that's actually functioning. And that's where we're at now.
Let's talk about Masmalo, the history of the building you're in. What did it used to be?
It started out as a jewelry store.
Wow.
And we still have the original vault in the building. And
really?
We actually turned it into a tequila room. So you, if you want to go in there and have like a party of 12 and do a, you know, a sampling of tequilas and food, we set it up for little private events. But the building itself, 1920s, was a jewelry store, and then eventually became Clifton Silver Spoon. Clifton's on Broadway was the buffet, you know, the cafeteria style.
Right. And that was all rooted with the recession and good prices because of that, right?
Right, absolutely. And so Silver Spoon was the coffee shop for them. And if you look on our building off of Wilshire, there's a big water tank at the top. And on the water tank, it still says Clifton Silver Spoon. They filmed part of Fight Club in there. If you remember the scene where they're sitting in the room and it says, don't eat the clam chowder.
Yeah.
The murals are still in the back, are still there. We have the original murals.
So that's where they filmed some of Fight Club in Moss Mallow.
Yeah.
Wow.
And after they filmed it, then it closed down shortly after that.
Now, how long has Moss Mallow been open?
We've been there 3 years.
Okay. How did that come together for you?
Rough. For me, at least. You know, the partners that put up the money that did it were own Echo, Echoplex, El Prado.
Those are your partners?
Yeah, and part of Spaceland. And I got called. I did the first one 10 years ago with a guy by the name of Stephen Arroyo from Cobras and Matadors. And got a call that we were working on a concept. I had just opened up two restaurants for him. And he said if I wanted to help him do this Mexican restaurant. And we ended up doing, coming up with the food and the menus and stuff. And we opened it, and it was crazy successful from day one. And then I left and went away and did some other things, you know, things we're not too proud of, maybe.
stuff you can't talk about,
Stuff we can talk about, right. got married and had some kids and, you know, got divorced and whatever not. But back to happier things. Ended up getting a call from, oddly enough, Mitchell Frank, who
Spaceland and Echoplex,
and said, "Hey, man, we want to do another restaurant, and we're doing downtown. We want you to come in and consult and get Malo back up to speed where you had it from before, where the food was, you know, they'd gone through some changes and some different incarnations of stuff." I said, "Yeah." So I went in, I did a month, I straightened out things, the food, and rewrote a menu, and they said, "You want to join us to do Moss Mallow?" And I said, "Absolutely not. You know, I'm trying to get out of your...
trying to get out of here.
Yeah, I'm trying to get out from in front of you as fast as I can." And it took some talking and some persuading. And finally, I said, "Okay, I'll come in." And so
did they make you an offer you couldn't refuse?
They made me an offer that I could refuse. But at
Mitchell
the time,
did.
I wasn't in a point
Mitchell
to refuse.
Did, right?
Yeah. So, and so I've been working really close with Jeff Ellermeyer. He's the principal... operating a manager, owner, partner guy. And we work really close together now. And it's me and him putting together a lot of the day-to-day. And so the vision for the restaurant right now is to go back to where it was, Mala was 10 years ago.
Okay.
And that's simple home-style
East LA comfort food. That's exciting.
And it's truly, you know, the LA comfort food that I remember growing up. It's not, you know... like a bunch of food on a plate with sour cream and cheese. And it's, you know, a few items, you know, it's one thing. It's sometimes just with beans, with rice. So sometimes it's just by itself. And that's the comfort food that I grew up with. I didn't grow up with, you know, meatloaf and stuff. I grew up with hard shell tacos and bean and cheese burritos. And like you told me earlier, which was so funny, I remember going to Dino's in Lincoln Heights and saying, "I want a bean and cheese burrito and a cheeseburger."
Yeah.
You know, and eating them both at the same time.
Yeah, a lot of times when I order, you know, from stands in East LA, it's that hybrid. I mean, when you go to Moss Mallow and order a bean and cheese burrito plate, it comes with like big French fries that would come in with a hamburger special. And that's like kind of like the East Side mentality. It's like you roll up to like, you know, this like Carnitas Michoacan on Whittier and Soto. And I'm like, "Oh, I'll take a bean and cheese burrito with just a cheeseburger."
Right.
Or you know, fries. And then like at the salsa bar, you put all the salsa on your fries.
Dump it on.
You know, and that's how you guys serve your plates. Like if you order a bean and cheese burrito, it comes with a side of fries and guacamole on top of the fries.
Right.
And that's very East Los.
Very East Los.
Yeah.
Completely East Los.
You know.
It's, we grew up poor. We didn't grow up wealthy. We had enough to be happy.
Right.
And so that one time you go out, you know, it's that weekend, it's that Friday night. You know, we used to go to Johnny's Shrimp Boat.
Oh, yeah.
You know, that was a big night out. You know, Friday night, Dad rolls in with the check. Hey, we're going to Johnny Shrimp Bowl. We're going to go. We're going to first, you know, we're going to La Placita, right. You know. And that was like really big, you know, because that was like expensive and the mariachis and I got to run around. It was craziness.
And you could be loud and no one's going to say stop, right?
So, man, what are you going to do? You order your food. Here it comes. You got the cheeseburger. You got the fries as a kid. And you want to put everything you could imagine on it.
Right.
Everything, you know, there's jalapenos, yeah, throw it on there. Salsa, yeah, put it on there. Yeah. Extra cheese, you know. Everything. And because that was your one night out. And so I wanted to recreate that. And our first menu, we had something called the Big Night Out. Oh, wow. And that was a steak, and there was a New York steak and lobster tail served Baja style, you know, with butter and jalapenos. And it was really popular. And so it was, eventually we moved the menu forward where we weren't... so worried about, you know, having the traditional item, the lobster and the thing, because of the area. And we brought down the menu a little bit where, you know, now we're topping out at like $16 for a plate for like the carne asada. And it comes with all the, you know, beans and rice and
that's
stuff.
That's current rates for Masmalo,
You know, and if you've looked at our building, I mean, if you've seen the interior, it's these vaulted ceilings with these frescoes and this woodwork and this marble floor.
It's really high end.
And so I'm trying to fill this place serving tacos. I'm trying to fill this place serving hard shell tacos for, you know, $12. And we're doing a good job.
That's great.
People love it.
That's great. Now, do you think... that the actual foot traffic you get during the day, is it the locals in downtown, or is your place a destination for non-downtowners on the weekends only, or you know what I'm saying?
Weekdays, we are definitely the businessman's lunch
destination.
Yeah, we're definitely the lawyers and, you know, the businessmen around the area and, you know, the businessmen out cheating on their wives with the secretaries, and it's very quiet, and, you know, because you can't see from the outside in, it's very exclusive and it's very private. And
so you can't see who's in there.
Yeah, it's very, very hidden. And at night, it's very much the guys from the west side that want to experience downtown, and they want to eat at the taco truck, but they're afraid to stand on, you know, on 7th and Olive. They're afraid to stand on
Los Angeles.
Right, exactly. So they come to us.
Right.
Because it's a safe environment. We got a valet, we got a nice bar, we got some music, the who's who there, and it's nice. So we get a lot of people from the west side coming in to experience downtown and at the same time experience a little bit of East LA.
Right. Now, have you noticed a spike in Mexican food?
Yeah.
As far as people, you know, when I say a spike, not just translating to sales, but the press coming to you and wanting to talk to you about what your menu is. And so forth. Because I remember 2 years ago, I saw you on Vista LA.
Right.
And it seems like, you know, after doing research, there was, you know, with your past history, there was a lot of press leading up to Masmalo as well. Do you think serving up Mexican food these days, it's not going away anytime soon?
No,
right?
It's not going anywhere. I mean, it's been here for so long. And it has stood the test of time. I mean, you've gone in and out of these different things, you know, California cuisine and all this other and this foofy and the thing. Mexican food's just been a constant, man. It's really what identifies L.A. To a cuisine, to a food, is Mexican food.
That's the attachment to L.A., the first thing. But also, I feel that you can't fuck it up.
No, it's hard. It's really hard.
How do you fuck up Mexican food?
Well, bean and cheese burritos, even when they're bad, are good.
Yeah, you know? I mean, if someone makes a bad one, it's good. I'll eat it.
Yeah, you know? I'll eat it. Put some more cheese on it. It'll go down.
Now, how often are you creating new items?
Daily.
And are you testing things out?
Yeah.
Can I be your tester?
Absolutely. We'll do another show and we'll bring some stuff to play with. you know, but I handle the bar program now.
Oh, let's talk about that.
You know, I handle the bar program at both locations. And, you know, I just, I came up, been doing now cocktails. And I've done menus before, but I haven't actually done the day-to-day. And so I'm starting to pick up a shaker and go behind the bar. And I'm working on menus for the restaurants. Oh. And what we're doing is we're incorporating a lot of the stuff that you'd find in cooking. Like we do a drink now with mole. We do a drink with...
You do a drink with mole now?
Yeah.
Is it available?
If you were to ask for it, and I'm there, you'll get it. But it's still in its development stages.
Wow.
And what we're doing is we're doing something called recodo, which is a burnt chili. It's like a chote, which is the annatto seed paste that they use in to color food, Mexican food. But this recodo is black. It's black. I mean, pick a black paint and it's blacker than that. And so what we're doing is we're taking that and we're diluting it with grapefruit juice. And we're actually roasting the chilies and we're making this black mole and we're doing a drink called the Apocalipto.
Oh, wow.
You know, and
Apocalipto.
So yeah, because it's, you know, black as day and it looks like the end of the world's coming. But it's actually really good. So I'm taking the helm a little bit more on the drink side of it and redoing the bar menu and working on the tequila program and trying to bring it back up to speed. And now we're serving, like, all our tequilas are served with sangrita, which is a fruit juice.
Right,
you know,
right.
People, you go to places and you get a sangrita and there's tomato in it.
Uh-huh.
It's not a real sangrita. Real sangrita is leftover fruit juice from the stands. And so when the guy would be done with the fruit, all the juice that was left.
The bottom.
He'd save all that juice with the chili and the limon and he'd drink that sip for sip with the tequila.
Okay.
And that's what sangrita is.
Now, I noticed too, inside Masmalo, you guys have the jugos.
Yes.
Yeah, that's very abnormal for a restaurant.
Very abnormal for a restaurant, especially in downtown on our 7th Street corridor.
You actually have the big tub. Yeah, haras. Yeah. And what, you have Jamaica?
They changed that. We always have Jamaica. We always have horchata, but the other ones on the bar, we did a watermelon. Yesterday we did melon. Tomorrow we're probably going to do like orange and cucumber, and they change up.
So you change it up?
Daily, yeah.
Wow. Now, do you think, as far as going back to the bar talk, is that more competitive than the food as far as the creating a menu versus creating a new bar item?
Yeah, it's definitely more creative.
Why? Just because there's more bars?
Because there's more bars. There's more people wanting to work in bars. There's more mixologists. It's not. It's still not a part of the restaurant that's dominated by Hispanics. You know, so there's a lot more people that are vocal about the position and they want a buck for that position. And whereas in the kitchen, you know, you have a line cook. I have line cooks that have been with me for 12 and 13 years. My sous chef started with me when he was 14.
Oh, wow.
At Cobras and Matadors, or 15, you know, and he's been with me ever since. And I travel wherever I go, he goes. And so Bernardo's been, you know, that constant in my life as far as like a sous chef, and trained him and he runs the ship. So those positions in the kitchen, there's not a lot of fight. But in the front of the house, in the bars, where it's, you know, very, very few Hispanics, you know, that are trying to be mixologists, there's a lot of talk. And so for a chef to take the position at the bar, it's not an easy task, you know.
I mean, at this day and age, you know, I mean, the business you're running is very boutique. You know, it's very boutique. It's a niche, but it reaches the masses. But don't you agree that because everyone has so much information at their fingertips that you have to get more clever with your marketing?
Man, you got to be, you got to cover your ass every which way. But, you know, because there's something, you know, there's one thing that I've learned, that you can say one thing and you get someone in and says, hey, man, that's not exactly what it says on that menu. They call you out. You know, and they can research everything in seconds at the table.
Right.
You know, you say, hey, these are black tiger shrimp, and they's at the phone looking at pictures. That's not black tiger shrimp, you know, and they call you out on it. So, yeah, it's become very, very
very nitpicky, right?
Absolutely.
And that's due to the, you know, the access of
wireless
devices and phones.
But I like it, actually.
Keeps you on your toes, right?
It does. It makes for a better product. It makes for a more true product. It cuts out the bullshit. It really makes things what they need to be and what they are, and it cuts to the chase. It cuts to the heart of it.
Now, are you? The question for you: have you ever seen Rick Bayless?
Yes.
You like it?
No.
Okay.
He's raping Mexico, and I don't appreciate it. And I don't like the bastardization of my food and my country and or my ancestry. You know, and because if I, you know, I could do the same thing. I could go to Mexico and go find a small village and find some lady that's making this amazing green mole. And I could go to her and offer $1,000 for her recipe. And she'd be think I was amazing and bring it here and sell it and make profit off of it. And yeah, I just don't, it doesn't resonate with me.
I get you.
And I don't understand the following of it. And I'd rather those things stay there.
In Chicago.
Yeah, stay in Chicago.
Stay in Chicago, Rick.
Yeah, don't come to
LA. On the Live Well Network,
right?
LBW,
right? You know, and so I see where the food is where it comes from, and I see what he's doing, and I'm not so big on it.
You know, for me, being an Angeleno and immersed in this culture, I watch it, and you know, I enjoy it, but I'm not coming from a perspective that you are, as far as you know, being a professional in a kitchen and running a restaurant as an executive chef. And I could see how that would definitely rub people the wrong way. At first, I was very defensive when I saw that. The whole Rick Bayless, you know, Rick Bayless thing. I thought it was kind of lame. Then I started watching it, and I give him credit for doing his research. And, you know, again, anyone could do research. But I'm happy that the platform exists to inform people that don't know. But I still think that, you know, LA's not represented on a televised level like it should be.
Right.
You know, so when I see this guy out of Chicago repping Mexican food, it's like, well, that doesn't really have anything to do with anything. Yeah. That you know.
You know, you read, if you go through and you read articles from Chicago about Mexican food,
yeah,
categorically, most people say that the best Mexican food in the United States is in Chicago. It's one of the things that people have read, and I read it everywhere and stuff.
Why is that?
You know, it's a different style of Mexican food. It's not necessarily the Mexican food that we are used to here in L.A. And our food here in L.A. is a little bit different from most Mexican food. It's not as heavy. It's not as drowned in sauce. We're not a very saucy Mexican style of food out here. And I don't think we've given our fair airtime. You know,
I agree.
I think that one of the things people associate with Mexican food is when they go to these restaurants, that it's like three items on a plate with big pounds of cheese and super amounts of sour cream. And not even that's really traditional Mexican food.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know,
that's pretty clear.
And so what we want to do is educate about one portion of L.A., which is East L.A. That's where our food, our style comes from. You know, and you can go to San Gabriel Valley. You can go to, you know, Pacoima. You can go to San Fernando Valley. You go to Santa Barbara. All the food varies.
It's regional.
Yeah.
It's very regional.
East L.A. style Mexican food is completely different. We eat ground beef. We eat ground beef in our tacos. Mm-hmm. We're not so much the asada or the street. We're more ground beef in our tacos. Our enchiladas have olives in them. Right. You know, there's green onions inside the mix with the cheese for the chile rellenos, you know. And so it's very indigenous to East L.A. And I think that right now we're not getting enough airtime. We're not spotlighted enough. And when we are, we're linked with other regions, you know, and it's not fair to...
It's not highlighted appropriately.
Right.
It's just like connected to something.
Sure.
Aside from Los Angeles.
Now, to be fair to Rick...
Right.
You know, what he's doing in some way is preserving a part of Mexico.
Well, that's what when I started paying attention, I was like, you know, okay, I'm not going to say this or think this because he's actually doing the research and there's work being put into this and there's a lot of knowledge being dropped on his behalf. But
I'm more upset that it's not one of us.
So am I completely. I mean, why isn't this, you know, why don't you have your own show?
Right.
You know, that's what I'm thinking. I mean, how come Los Angeles isn't highlighted as a platform for the amazing Mexican food? And it's coming out of Chicago by Rick Bayless on the Live Well Network.
Right. Yeah, we need, you know, Robert Luna on the Viva Bueno Network.
Yeah.
You know, it's,
yeah.
But it, so, you know, whatever it is, you know, in all fairness, he found something that he was good at. He found something that, you know, he could attach himself to. And great. Good for him.
Exactly.
But could it be done better? Could it be done by someone that speaks the language a little bit better, that understands the culture, someone that understands the art a little bit better? Not saying that he doesn't, but if you're Mexican and you actually have a link to it, it means a little bit more. And there's a little bit more process.
Because you're actually connected to the...
Emotionally.
Emotionally,
and physically, and mentally,
and in the bloodline,
right? And that's, you know, it that's where,
and that goes for anything, not just Mexican food.
No,
I mean, if it's a Japanese
everything.
Food show, you know, I mean, anything. I mean, it would be nice if someone is presenting that, you know
it's not saying that, you know, it's anti everyone else, but I would expect that, you know, if I wanted to learn about Japanese food, I'd probably learn from a Japanese guy, you know, and he'd probably have a better link to it and a better understanding of it. And how food itself is linked with art and linked with music.
Well, if I want to take jazz guitar lessons, I don't want to take it from some guy at MI that has long hair.
Right.
That's some rock dude. It's like I want to take it from a real jazz player.
Right.
You know what I mean? That's the same thing. Now, as far as you guys doing a third Malo, do you think that's going to happen anywhere?
It should happen. It probably will happen. But at the moment... we're just trying to get everything over the 3-year hump.
Right.
And so
reach that plateau.
Right.
And so it just goes.
Once you make 3 years, you're probably going to be around for a while.
Okay.
So
now let's talk about that walking tour you just gave.
Oh, that was amazing.
Yeah, yeah. So you took a group of people to the produce district, yeah. Right? Let's talk about that.
I got a call from a lady from something called Atlas Obscura.
Okay.
And they're based in New York, Chicago, Seattle, all the major cities. And what they do is they do walking tours. And they said, you know, we have some interest in doing the produce market. And we'd like for someone to give the tour. And we read your bio and we saw you on the net and we like your food. And you seem like the perfect guy. And they follow me on Instagram. And we see you at the market all the time posting pictures of the market. And I say, yeah, I'm there twice a week at least. They say, well, how would you like to give a tour? I said, I'd love to. It'd be great. And we met up and they brought 12 people that had just recently moved to L.A., that knew nothing about the produce market, knew nothing about Candy Row, which is Olympic, wow. Where it's piñatas and candy.
Oh, where you get the piñatas. Yeah. And they'll make any piñata for like 20 bucks.
Yeah.
Anything you can make Chewbacca, Yoda.
And a taco.
And you get a taco from the, yeah.
Right. So,
or a raspada.
Right. And a raspada. So they, I took them on a tour. Took a 2-hour walk around the produce market, and it was really amazing. It was, I had learned things about the markets that I had forgotten, like that I used to go there when I was a kid with my mom. My mom owned restaurants throughout LA when I was a kid, little hamburger stands and stuff. And I forgot. I remembered walking through, actually looking at the buildings and remembering, you know, man, I remember being here. And we took the back alley on some of them, where Rykoff Sexton was, mm-hmm. where American Apparel is now. Now, it used to be Rykoff, which was the king of all food purveyors when I grew up.
Is that where Rykoff was, where American Apparel is now?
Yeah.
Wow.
And so, you know, I walked those alleys with the people and it was like, man, I remember coming here with my mom buying donuts at 4 a.m. for her place. And then she'd, you know, I'd be asleep in the back. She'd go pick up meat. She'd go to the restaurant. She'd dump me off at school. She'd run back. And so it was good. I really enjoyed it. I think that there should be more tours. I think there should be more people walking the city.
Yeah, that's exciting. We're going to take another break, and we're going to come back with more Robert Luna from Masmalo. Thank you very much. Hi, this is Eddie Solis. You're listening to Los Angeles Nista on SkidRowStudios.com. We'll be right back. So you go because you know what you need.
Right.
And the quantities and what exactly you need to buy.
Right.
So, I mean, how much earlier do you have to get up to do all this?
5 a.m.
You get up at 5?
Yeah, I leave the house around 5. But, you know, I could order from a company, bring me exactly the same product.
Right. And it will arrive at the restaurant.
At the restaurant, the exact same quantity.
Mm-hmm.
It's probably, maybe at some levels, even maybe better quality.
Really?
But I'd rather support the guys that are doing it day by day, the guys that are bringing in from the farm, the guys that are out there with their kids selling. And, you know, as much as like you think of like you go to a farm and you got the guys out there picking with their families and they're out there, they're doing the same thing in downtown L.A. These guys are out there.
It's the same kind of strategy, right?
Yeah. There's guys out there with their kids and they're running these shops and they're really trying to make a go at it. I'd rather give them the business and support them.
Right.
Then
with maybe the cash in their hand.
With the cash in their hand, as opposed to having some big company come in. And at the end of the day, I mean, you know, we're a business. We're there to make money. And we do save money by going to them.
Sure.
So it's a dual-edged sword that cuts well on both sides.
Let me ask you a question. It seems like, I mean, obviously, one would think that's more work, right?
Yes.
To go do it yourself. Like you said, you could order online and place an order and have it delivered to your doorstep daily if you needed to.
Right.
Don't you think that's part of the fun, though? Like doing you create the menu, you get out of bed earlier than everyone, and you go get the produce, and you bring it back, and you prep it, and then you make it, and then people order, and then that's your day. Your day starts.
There's some gratification knowing who has your food before you actually have it in your hand. The guy that brought it in, the guy that at 6 o'clock in the morning on every Thursday is there with a donut and a cup of coffee for you because you're bringing him, you know, a few $1,000 worth of business in one day.
Right.
And it's gratifying. It's good to know that you matter to somebody out there and that they matter to you. You know, it's
and I think that coffee and donut, it could be really anything, but it just shows like there's just like a really nice like support system in place for each other. That's all stems off good honest business, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Now When do you get to the restaurant after a produce day and start prepping?
Well, we're not done yet.
Uh-huh.
We got to go pick up a few more items.
Okay.
I pick up all my own meat.
Okay.
And that's going to several different butchers, one of which is called Zacatecas Meat Market.
Wow.
And we've been buying meat for him. I set up the program at Malo 10 years ago, and he's been the same meat guy for us for 10 years.
Where's Zacatecas located?
Pico in Arlington.
Okay.
And a small mom and pop. It's like literally, at some point, it was at the point where it was going to like bust. It was going to go out because the laundromat next door to him was under construction. And so it was a big, and you know, that's where half the business came from. And he made it through. They finally finished and he's doing better. And I wouldn't switch. It's
you're very loyal to your vendors, right?
Very loyal. It's good business for me to be loyal to someone that's loyal to me. And, you know, I could be Sunday afternoon. I can't get meat anywhere else. I call him and, oh, sir, no problem. I'll bring it right over. I'll be right there. You know,
he'll deliver it on Sunday.
Yeah, absolutely.
If you're short
if need be. Same. So after the meat, then we hit the spice market. And that includes picking up all the chilies and all the dry goods and the achiote and we use like 7 different dry chilies in the restaurant. So we have to hand pick all that stuff up. And when I say hand pick, it's like one batch is hotter than another. So you need to sample each package so they match up.
You have to actually sample them.
Yeah. Wow. And you smell and you do the taste and you check the seeds and make sure they're not too dry and make sure that they're not old and all that.
I mean, it seems like there's a whole math to it.
Somewhat,
it really is.
Yeah, absolutely. And then after that, we're still not done. we got to go, you know, we have to, we go pick up some of the canned goods that we use. And right now we're at probably less than 5% canned good in the restaurant.
Wow.
And the only reason being is that there's some things that we can't get. One of which right now, short supply of pumpkin flowers are on short supply. So we're having to get a canned one in until we get past this dry season.
Yeah.
And then we'll go back to the fresh. And so there's a lot of picking up and a lot of knowing where to go and knowing the nooks and crannies of LA.
And this is about twice a week.
The produce, all that happens twice a week.
Wow.
Twice a week.
So you're actually getting up that early, making all the stops, coming back to the restaurant.
Right.
And then prepping.
And then prepping.
So there, I mean, that's already like 3 huge destinations.
Oh yeah.
You know, that you accomplished before opening the restaurant doors.
Right.
Wow. And then when do you get to a restaurant on a day like that?
Well, Tuesday, I'm probably at the restaurant around 11:30. And then I get ready for lunch. And we do all the specials in-house. And if we're going to use a bread, we bake the bread. And if we're making a special dessert, we bake the cakes. And everything that we can do in-house, we do in-house. And that's right now 95% is done in-house. We were making all our own tortillas. And we're making, you know, we're doing, if we made tamales over the holidays, we ground our own corn to make the tamales. And, you know, my guys hate me for it, but it's the only way to ensure that our product is the best it can be. And even at that level, that commitment to making a good product, sometimes you still fall short. So imagine if we were using, you know, canned goods or we're using other, like Maseca as opposed to fresh corn, you know.
It's a standard that you already set. So,
yeah.
I mean, that's really killer. Now, let's talk about your toy store, vintage toy store that you are involved in.
Yeah.
Okay. It's called?
Screws.
Screws.
Old school toys, skateboards, and oddities.
Okay, yeah. Now, at the break, we were talking about the Shogun Warriors. Now, those old Shogun Warrior figures stood about, what, a foot and a half high?
24 inches.
24 inches.
Yep.
Plastic.
Plastic.
And it came in the boxes that you...
Big, giant, beautiful box.
And it would be like Guy King. And
right.
I know what's
Dragoon.
Yeah.
The Great Mazinga. And And then oddly enough, you know, they had these great robots and they said, you know, what would be complete without like Godzilla? So they threw Godzilla as a part of the show.
I remember that. He was part of that. Yeah, Rodan and Godzilla were part of that series.
Right.
And
his hands used to fire out.
Yeah, and he had the tongue.
Yeah, the tongue lasher.
Yeah, and you would come out and they had fire painted on the tongue.
So rad.
And then you'd have the...
He's actually our logo for the store.
Okay.
Is that Godzilla.
Now, obviously that stuff is out of print, right?
Oh, yeah.
Now, since the 70s or early 80s, have there ever been any reissues?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Unify. And then, Unified did one, and then Seven, you know, the guys that do they do some reissue stuff. But yeah, there's been a couple of reissues on them. Not as nice as the first ones.
Right.
Like the plastic was really like
thick,
durable, and you could like smash them on your brother's head.
My dog would be chewing it, and I'd take it, and it's like, oh, there's no bite marks.
Right.
Just hit the dog.
Right. So, but yeah, there's been a couple. They're still super expensive. I mean, even the reissues are hard to come by.
Well, I remember back in the day, you know, I think I was living in Monterey Park back in the day, and we'd go to like Toy Villa in East Los. Remember that?
Yeah. Toy Town on Valley.
Toy Town on Valley, all that stuff. And, I remember back in the day, like this is 1980, 1982. I was between five and seven, and these Shogun Warriors were probably about $50 at the time.
Yeah, expensive.
$59.99 at that time.
Yeah.
And you know, that was a pretty penny for a toy.
Yeah.
So I mean, what do you sell those at right now?
I have a Dragoon in the box right now at the shop. He's up at $400.
Okay.
And then
I've looked online. That's about going right.
Yeah. And then I have a shrink wrapped NOS, like, which is new old stock Godzilla, still in the box, never removed, with all the inserts. He's up at $800.
Originally shrink wrapped.
Yeah.
Wow.
All NOS. Wow. But I'm a hoarder. Yeah, I'm a certified
good for
hoarder.
You.
I've been hoarding for like 20 years. So
now all that stuff that we're talking about, you know, that's my cup of tea. So you have the Godzilla,
right,
from that series.
Oh, I have all of them from the series.
You have all of them.
But the only one that's...
Personally or for sale?
No, personally.
Okay.
The loose ones are for sale, not the box ones.
Not the box ones.
Yeah.
You got to like that.
Yeah. And the shop consists of everything like Star Wars, G.I. Joes, Hello Kitty from the 70s.
70s Hello Kitty. Yeah. Wow.
My Little Pony, Rainbow Bright, okay, Care Bears, Strawberry Shortcake.
Let's talk Star Wars really quick.
Let's talk Star Wars.
Okay, because that's what I'm all about. I don't subscribe to this Star Trek crap.
Right. And
at all. So you too, right?
It broke my heart when I heard J.J. Abrams was going to direct the new Star Wars thing. I was like, what the fuck? Really? Come on, man.
Yeah, dude.
You do Star Trek, buddy. You don't do the Star Wars.
That's just movie politics.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
Yeah, so, okay. So original Star Wars,
right.
1977 action figures, first
right.
movie, in the package, still sealed, like... I'm talking Jawas,
right.
Stormtroopers, Death Star Commander,
right.
Obi-Wan, Han Solo, Leia in the white outfit,
right.
Sand People,
right.
You know, the Cantina guys, Greedo, Snaggletooth, Hammerhead, Walrus Man, all that stuff.
All that
Like,
stuff.
What's that going for loose and what's that going for in the package?
Because
I need it.
Loose, you could pick up loose figures for anywhere from like $5 and up, you okay. know, if they have their weapons. Package stuff with the 12 back, which means there's only 12 figures on the back of the package.
Because that's all there was.
That's
at the
all
time.
There was. Vinyl Cape Jawa, I sold about a year ago for $2,300. I just sold a Star Wars, I just sold a 12 back Stormtrooper online for $900.
That's sick.
So the money's, it's big money.
You
it's
know, and I'm looking
super
for a
collectors.
12 back Power Droid.
No. No.
Is that hard?
Yeah, you're not going to get one.
That's rare?
Yeah.
Do you have it?
No. No,
so you know where I'm coming from. You're like, no.
No.
Ain't going to happen.
No, not going to happen.
Like, if you had that 12-back power droid.
There's a few things that...
Like, what would that go for, you think? Like, 3K, 4K?
Oh, easily.
Easy, right?
Easily. You know, the big one right now that is Vlix from the cartoon.
Yeah.
The droids cartoon.
Yeah.
He was only available in Brazil.
Yep.
And there's some counterfeits here and there. But if you find a real one packaged, you're talking anywhere from $5,000 on up.
Now, in 1984, I remember I saved up enough proof of purchase.
To get your mail away?
Bar.
Right. To get the mail away.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, if you still had it in the original box, you know, it'd be worth a few dollars.
Yeah, he came in a white plain
mailer.
Box. Remember
yeah.
that?
With General Mills stamped on.
Huh? Yeah, General Mills, dude. What the hell?
Yeah.
Now, now on to Empire Strikes Back.
Right.
Okay. Hoth Wampa.
Right.
Okay.
With the playset.
Yeah, okay. Hoth Wampa. Do you have one of those?
Yes.
Store? Okay, is it in the box?
I do have one in the box.
Okay. Now, what about the Hoth playset?
I do have a Hoth playset.
Now, that's where you build the bridge and you could...
And it has the turret and the little... the probe, the power cannon.
Right.
And the radar.
Oh.
Yeah.
So heavy.
Yeah, I got a couple of those.
Oh, wow.
Because, you know, I think I'd sell my children for toys at some point. I was like, Johnny, I didn't mean that. I love you, baby.
No, I mean, there's something about looking at the packaging. It's so simple. But, you know, like when you just look at the live shot from the movie on the back part of where the figure is like glued or, you know, just
this
installed.
This is, you know, when I grew up, in 1977, I was 5, and I got for Christmas an X-Wing.
Okay.
And the box. And it had, like, little radar thing, and there was a picture of a kid, a blonde-haired kid, flying it, and it was, like, the orange, and it was black. It was like, whoa, that's going to be amazing. I ripped it open, and I got it, and it was like, okay, that's not so much fun.
Yeah.
I fell in love with the packaging.
That's what it was.
And from there, that's why I have so much inventory right now that's not opened, because I'm the original owner of it. I mean, I have everything boxed and carded from G.I. Joe, Transformers, from like 1979 till 1989, 90. Wow. Boxed and carded. You name the series, I got the toy. You know, SWAT Cats, you know, Inspector Gadget, Ren and Stimpy, all the stuff from the 90s. And back in the 80s, Indiana Jones.
What about GoBots?
GoBots.
Leader One.
From Tonka, man.
Tonka,
the poor man's Transformer.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Now, the Transformers, I mean, I remember, you know what was rad? Is when my mom bought me Megatron. And I just thought it was so badass that, like, you know, Soundwave or Shockwave would turn, or, you know, the Dinobots would turn into, like, these dinosaurs, right, or Thrust and Dirge would be jets. But Megatron turned into a cuete.
He was just a gun. He said, what's up, eh?
Like he's a giant robot, and then he turns into a fucking gun.
Right. Just a big gun in space flying around, you know,
blasting shit. People. Like, what's up? You want some?
I got your back, eh? Fuck it. I said, what's up, homie?
That's like the OG Methodon Megatron.
That was it, dude. He came with a bandana, you know.
Yeah.
And a spray can.
Right? You know what I'm saying? Like, that's true, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So... As far as Transformers go, I mean, do you have a pretty nice selection of those as well?
Yeah. My collection's pretty crazy when it comes to the 80s stuff.
Wow.
Transformers, like Optimus Prime, box and sealed, Soundwave box and sealed, all the Cliff Jumpers. Like, you know, Bumblebee's like this big giant Camaro now, but before
he's a little Volkswagen.
A little Volkswagen.
And the way he was packaged
on a card,
he was like the Star Wars figures.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the 5 small robots from the Autobots, they were all packaged that way, like Huffy and Brawn.
Yeah,
and who else was there?
There was going back to the cards. Was the Sears exclusive was the Devastator?
Oh, the Constructicons.
The Constructicons,
yeah.
Which turned into be, you know, the big. But all the small Cliff Jumpers, if you can find them carded, there's so many bootlegs now. But
yeah,
you know, they're a couple $100 for a set.
About skateboarding.
No.
Now, are you carrying new stuff or are you carrying vintage stuff?
In the area I'm at, I'm in Virgil Village, which is Virgil and Melrose. I'm down the street from like Cha-Cha-Cha in between Skrull Preserve. I'm on that block. A lot of skaters in the area, a lot of kids. And so at first I brought in, you know, a lot of vintage old skateboards and stuff, a lot of autograph stuff, a lot of one-offs and stuff, protos and stuff. And it wasn't working. I started bringing in like used skateboards that I'd buy, pay 25, turn them around, complete decks, sell them for $50 and $60 for the kids in the neighborhood, you know? And so you can go buy a blank and get some trucks and some wheels for 50, or you can get like a really nice, you know, like Element or Baker, or, you know, Chocolate or, ghetto kid, skateboard for 50. And so it serves a need for the kids in the neighborhood.
That's cool.
And that's where it's at.
So you actually like did that to like keep a low price point for the kids in the neighborhood?
More so the store right now is more like a storage for me. Because I go there on Sundays. I put on the TV. I kick it. And
Is that where you kick it?
Yeah, on Sundays, man. My kids come over and like we'll watch movies. We'll order takeout. And, you know, if we happen to sell something,
Right.
And, you know, we get kids from the neighborhood coming in like, hey, I need trucks. And, you know, oddly enough, I have, you know, a couple hundred trucks available that, you know.
Pairs.
Yeah, you know, that are used and they still grind. They're still good. I'll turn them over to the kids for, you know, $15.
That's cool.
So,
I mean, because usually they're like $45 bucks for a set.
Right.
$50.
The thing for the neighborhood is that it's still an up-and-coming neighborhood. It's not where it eventually will be. You know, we're probably about 4 years out. So we're at the beginning. So rent's really cheap. The neighborhood's changing. It's kind of the new inexpensive place to move in Hollywood, that you're still by Los Feliz, you're still by Silver Lake.
Right.
And so we're on the ground floor. And we're going to stick it out by servicing and helping
and it's
out.
It's East Hollywood.
Yeah, East Hollywood.
On Melrose.
Yeah.
And that's between Virgil and what else?
Between Melrose and Marathon.
Okay.
On Virgil.
So. Well, thank you very much, Robert. It was a great episode.
Yeah, it was awesome. Glad I was here.
Thank you very much.